What can a lifetime of doing yoga tell you about yourself? Is yoga a pathway to truth or just a good way of stretching? What's the most important thing for casual practitioners of yoga to know? This week, yoga teacher Amy Owen on 9 Questions with Eric Oliver.
Hey everyone. Andrea is not feeling well this week, so you're going to have me doing this introduction solo here. Wanted to talk about yoga. So I first heard of yoga in the 70s, I think. It was on the local PBS station in Houston where I grew up, and there was this woman in black tights, and she talked really calmly. And as a child, I would look at that, and it seemed really, really strange. And I didn't really know what to think about yoga for a long time. Until the 90s, and I was living in Berkeley, and I was doing a lot of athletic stuff, and I was having a lot of back problems and muscle strain. And I had a roommate who said, "Hey, why don't you come to yoga class with me?" And I'm like, "Okay, sure, I'll just try that. Why not?" And it was a revelation. And what it was a revelation for me was I had always thought that physicality meant getting strong, like developing one's strength and core capabilities. And what I didn't realize was that you needed flexibility to go along with the strength. And if you just had strength by itself, you would get a lot of tension, back spasms, problems. And that flexibility is really one of the key components for getting along well through life. And so I started really getting very enthusiastic about yoga, and I have been practicing it on and off ever since. And I wanted to have a yoga teacher on for the show because yoga has been so great for me and so instructive. But the problem is that it's been hard to find a good one. A lot of yoga instructors either tend to be kind of like flighty and new agey, or some of them have this megalomania guru quality as if they have some private access to some sublime truth. And then a couple of years ago, my wife Thea started taking yoga classes with this woman, Amy Owen, and she said, "Oh, you should come to Amy's class. It's really great." So I did. And Amy is just a delight. And after doing a few classes with her, I said, "Okay, she's the person who I'd really love to have on the podcast to talk about yoga." So let me tell you a little bit about Amy. Amy Owen is a birth doula, meditation teacher, and yoga instructor here in Chicago. She started her career in the 1980s as a fashion model and began practicing meditation in her early 20s. A few years later, she learned yoga and has been teaching yoga since 2008. She created the Outreach Prenatal Yoga Program serving Northwestern's hospital ambulatory care patients and piloted the Yoga for Recovery BAMS program, bringing prenatal yoga to expectant inmates at the Cook County Jail. So, as you can probably tell from this little brief bio, Amy is a very interesting person, and she has a lot of really interesting insights into what a life of practicing meditation and yoga and spiritual seeking can offer us. So, it's my great pleasure to share with you my conversation with Amy Owen. Amy, it's so great to have you on. So thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast. And I want to start with our first question, which is, who are you?
I am someone who thrives on love and authenticity and meaningful connection. Specifically, I am a woman. I identify as female. I'm a mom. I'm a yoga instructor. And I'm a birth doula.
So tell me a little bit about how you came into those identities.
From a state of suffering. Uh-huh. So difficult childhood. Uh-huh. And having kind of that dark night of the soul at about 15, 16. And randomly being in Tokyo, Japan, and picking up a book on Eastern philosophy. And I laugh. It was Shirley MacLaine's Out on a Limb. So if you want to call that Eastern philosophy.
Sure,
but that was my intro, my soft, fluffy intro to self-inquiry, and meditation.
Yeah.
And then I went, autobiography of a yogi and, went deep.
Right,
but
right.
I started meditating. I didn't start meditating until I was about 17 or 18. It just relieved me of a lot of suffering.
And were you back here in the States at the time, or were you in Asia?
I was actually living in Europe.
Okay.
At the time.
So tell me a little bit about, just so we can ground where this spiritual journey is actually taking place. So you were born and raised, were you born and raised here in Chicago?
Yeah.
Okay. Born and raised here, traveling around. What takes you to Europe?
My former life, I was a fashion model.
Okay.
So after high school, well, I was in Tokyo, Japan, modeling in between summers of, I think, sophomore and junior year of high school. And then when I graduated from school, I deferred a year. I was going to go to NYU or USC. I hadn't chosen. And I said, I want to take a year off and I want to go to Europe and model. Okay. A European modeling agency had scouted me and offered me this contract. So despite my parents' huge dismay and paying for a private education for 14 years,
yeah.
I 3 days after high school graduation, I packed my bags and I took off. And I went to Milan,
okay.
Italy. So there it was.
And so that seems an unlikely place to kind of pursue spiritual transcendence.
Yes. I was a closeted meditator at the time. It wasn't something I spoke about with anyone. It was kind of like my own personal thing. And it felt, I think, so personal that I didn't even almost want to share it. It just felt like it was for me only. And I was exploring it and I didn't really know what it meant at the time, but it was so grounding. I really felt like it was like anchoring me to this life and to earth. Whereas I was somebody who kind of lived up in my head.
And were you finding instruction? How were you doing this at the time?
So I came back to Chicago. I was in Chicago for August. So I went to Europe, was there for 2 months. And then I didn't know that in August, everyone leaves and the whole continent shuts down. So I was like, oh, I'm not going to be working this month. So I came back home and I had read about transcendental meditation. So I looked up in the yellow pages, this is how long it was. And there was a center in Chicago and I called and they're like, oh, we're starting a session this week.
Okay.
So I went.
Oh, so you were doing TM?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I did TM for a long time.
Okay. So you're doing that. You're in Milan. You have your year. What happens next?
I ended up coming back to the U.S., lived in New York for a while, and then my mom was sick, so I came back to Chicago to be with her, and ended up meeting a guy, getting married, and then getting a divorce soon after, and I like needed to take off. It was kind of like my eat, pray, love. So I decided I was going to do a meditation retreat in Nepal. Mm-hmm. So I went to Nepal, and at that meditation retreat, we did yoga. And I had been reading all these books about these yogis, but for me, it was always meditation. It wasn't about the physical practice of hatha yoga. And we did yoga, and I was like, oh, this feels really good. I was super active as a kid, but I was, I think, pretty disconnected from my body, and I was very stiff, just stiff and meek. And so it just felt good. Again, it kind of felt like meditation felt like coming home to myself. Yoga felt like I was coming home to my body and kind of befriending it in a way and tending to it in a very caring, loving way.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because when I encountered yoga, I had been doing a lot of exercise. I'd been doing triathlons. I'd been working out. I had this idea that I needed to be strong. But I was getting all these muscle spasms and I was getting I had all these like physical issues that were arising from that singular focus on like strength. Mm. And then after I had my first yoga class, it was like, oh, flexibility is the other half of the equation. Yeah. And that was like an amazing experience. Like, oh, okay. That's, I've been missing and neglecting this other half of my whole physicality.
Exactly.
So, you encounter yoga in Nepal. Mm-hmm. And then how do you then go into exploring and training and doing around a life around that?
So when I was pregnant with my first baby, before that I was traveling all the time for modeling. So I was always on shoots. I had no semblance of a schedule. So it was very difficult to go to classes. So I would take a class here or there. When I was pregnant with my firstborn, I couldn't model because I was pregnant. And so I was like, this is my opportunity to do yoga. So I don't know. Do you know Gabriel Halpern? It's just Yoga Circle. He was kind of the first studio in Chicago back in the 70s.
Okay.
So called him up. I knew he was the guy. And I said, do you have prenatal yoga? And he said, no, but just come to my class. I'll take care of you.
Yeah.
So that's what I did. So then I just continued doing yoga regularly and getting more into it and more into it. Eventually, I went and did my yoga teacher training. But I didn't do it to become a teacher. I just wanted to study it more.
Yeah.
And I wanted the philosophy because I'd been reading all these books on my own. And I knew that that was part of the yoga teacher training. And I thought, oh, God, how luxurious to sit in a circle with other people that are studying this stuff and talk about it. So I went and then one of my teachers said, you know, use it or lose it. So you need to start teaching right away. And I thought, oh, I'll just teach in my kids' school, a volunteer here or there. And so I just started doing that.
Let's go into the hard question here, which is, what are you?
I am a spiritual being in a human form.
Okay.
Who is fluid and ever changing.
Let's start with spiritual being. What does spiritual mean to you?
Yeah, I guess by that, I mean that the big self, the capital S self, and the small self. So the big self, the spiritual being, is that I am pure consciousness. Uh-huh. That I am this part of this, and I am the ocean, right, of consciousness. Within that, I am the small self. I am the drop of water that goes into the ocean and is part of the ocean, but also has this separateness, the separate, you know, self, ego, personality, whatever you want to call it. And for me, that's the human form.
In the Hindu tradition, there's this idea of Brahman, which is sort of this greater consciousness. There's Atman, which is trying to then reintegrate within Brahman. And I don't know if that's what's as informing your perspective here.
Yeah, it's definitely a Buddhist teaching. Uh-huh. And it is this feeling of being part of this greater thing and also being this individual, this personality. So I just feel like there's something more than this, being in this human being and being a human being and being in this human life. And it's nonverbal, it's tangible, it's like the slippery soap in our hand that just, you know, we try to grab it and I get tastes of it when I'm in seated meditation, but then it's like, it's gone. But I've had those tinges of feeling on a very cellular, energetic level that I can't totally articulate, but it feels so good to be in that place. And really it comes down to this, like the energy is love.
Yeah.
This love that is completely available and all around us and within us all the time.
All right. So that's the first half of the equation. Mm-hmm. And then let's pick up the second half, being fluid and ever changing. So what does that entail?
For me, the only constant in life is change. Every morning we wake up, I feel like it's an opportunity. It's a clean slate. And we approach the day, we can approach our life completely differently. So I like, it's kind of the optimist in me that feels like at any moment you can pivot and change your life. Also, if you don't want to change your life, good luck, because we are just always ever changing. Like we're just not static. We're just not static as human beings.
I mean, and that's, I think, perhaps one of the biggest challenge is because that we face is that our minds are prediction machines and we want to order everything and we want to know what's going to happen next. And that's what our minds evolved to do. And we want to know everything's stable. We want to know things. How do we get comfortable with change? And maybe I'll just ask you, how do you get comfortable with change?
I get comfortable with change by always or practicing, trying to be in the present moment and being open to whatever is happening or in front of me.
Let's move on to question three, which is, what is your purpose?
My purpose is really to be present in every given moment in my life, which is not doable as a human, but it's what I strive towards. And in order to alleviate the inherent suffering that we have as human beings, my own personal suffering, and to be open and awake to the magic and wonderment of this life. Carpe diem, take it in every moment, every day is precious, mm-hmm. and to take a hold of it and be in it, because before you know it, it's going to be done.
How do we live in the moment in turmoil?
For me, being in the present moment, even in the hard times, is like fully feeling it, fully living in it, being in it, and moving through it in all your sensories, being there.
This has been a big challenge for me as well. And I, you know, this is something that's come up in therapy. When you're in a state of discomfort, moving into the pain, my shrink would always say, move into the pain. I'm mm-hmm. like, okay, oh, this pain sucks. I want this pain to stop. And like, I'm not even clear, where do I go here? You know, like, so I was wondering if you could share a little bit about like, what do you do? Like, how do you push into that?
So one of the things I do is yoga. Uh-huh. So what we know is that emotions only last, 60 to 90 seconds.
Yeah.
The science is there. After that, we are just on a loop in our minds going around and around. So you may, have an emotion, really upset, something just happened. How do you move it all the way through you? Because what happens is we get these emotions and then they get stuck in our body. So movement is one of them. Meditation is one of them. Creativity is one of them. Journaling, writing is one of them.
Can we talk a little bit about yoga in mm-hmm. this? Mm-hmm. So what have you learned, I guess, about coexisting with discomfort? What has yoga taught you about sort of coexisting with discomfort?
You know, for me, it's always like stepping onto the mat is the hardest part. And then you get on and you're right. Like the first, it's kind of like seated meditation. The first 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you're like, this is so hard. My head's going, I can't do this. And then you kind of sink into it. So for me, it's yoga. It's about kind of taking things to the edge. Mm-hmm. And I think going to my edge and pushing my system a little bit further than where it's comfortable has helped me get comfortable with the uncomfortable parts of life. It's like the practice on the mat, you take it off the mat and you take it into your life. But there's something about how that it just works for me. It has bled out and that I'm able to do that. So being the chronic avoider, suddenly I don't avoid as much, because in yoga, it's like facing those poses that I don't really like and trying to go a little deeper, a little bit further. But overall, I've loved the challenge and like the amazement of what my body can do.
Why don't we move on then to the next question, which is, who's writing your life story?
I am.
Okay. And how did you get to be in that position?
Early on, realized it was up to me, not my parents, to either make this a great life or not, and that I needed to take matters into my own hands. And that's when I really discovered, Eastern philosophy and meditation and all that. So that was, since then, I have felt very much in the driver's seat of my story, and how it's unfolding.
You mentioned earlier about like having a kind of challenges when you were younger and, moving through a lot of pain. And it seems like oftentimes those are the things that end up defining our story, our early traumas, our survival strategies end up sort of being what our narrative is about. And then writing our own story is, I'm not going to be a victim anymore. I'm not going to be the person who was from the, abusive parent or the shitty upbringing or any number of things.
I think part of it is definitely that victim, like really not wanting to be the victim and learning how to take, like I call it, radical accountability for myself, my actions, and my words. So I think I try to live by that of not being the victim of other people and circumstances, but really seeing, how did I play into this scenario and this circumstance? And how do I move through it and move on from it and make a better decision, a different decision? I'm constantly checking in and being like, who am I? Who do I want to be? What lights me up? What am I passionate about? And then just constantly moving in that direction. And are there pitfalls and things that come in the way? Absolutely. But I feel like it's my duty, responsibility. It's my life. It's myself to, I don't want to stay in anything or any circumstance that feels that way. So to figure out a way forward or to make a change. So that's kind of the idea of like, I feel like I'm always changing. I'm always evolving. You know, we're not the same person we were in our 20s. We're certainly not the same person we were, you know, growing up. But there's a thorough line, you know, there's a thread that I can recognize myself at all those times. But just with age and with experience, things have, you know, I've evolved. And fortunately, I feel pretty content about where I am right now.
Yeah. Well, I think this actually segues nicely into our next question, mm-hmm. which is, what are your dreams telling you?
My dreams are telling me that the subconscious is just as vital and alive and informative as our conscious mind. For me, for a long time, I kept dream journals and I would, you know, read books on what does this mean? What does that mean? And try and kind of put it together. And it would be interesting to see what came up for me. Now I don't do that. What I've learned to do, and I don't remember where I got this from, but I tested it out and it works pretty well. So before I go to sleep, what I've learned is that in your subconscious can actually do a lot of problem solving for us.
Yeah.
So when I am stuck, when I am dealing with a different difficult circumstance or whatever, facing upheaval and challenges, I'm like, I'm going to ask myself a question. I'm going to ask for an answer. And I'm going to go to bed and I'm going to wake up and see what comes.
Do you write it down or do you just say to yourself, okay?
I just think it.
Yeah. So,
and it's often when I wake up and I go, oh, nothing. And then I'll go about my day and then I get like a light bulb, like, oh, this is how I should handle this situation. Or, oh, this is such a brilliant idea for my book.
What are your dreams telling you about your unconscious mind?
That it's so like vast and dynamic and contradictory. There's just this whole world that is nonverbal, you know, that is beyond intellectual understanding. And so for me, it's almost like a fantasy land. Like I see it as like a really cool, fun place to go to. Uh-huh. And that's why I loved remembering my dreams, because I just thought, oh, the landscape, it's like another world. It's like opening up a novel and something else is happening.
I'll set this question out and I'll see how you react and we'll see, maybe we'll refine it. How, not what, are you feeling?
How I personally feel, because I think I was so disconnected to that for so long, is through my meditation and yoga practice. Those are opportunities to be connected to my body and to feel things on a visceral, physical level that I wasn't in touch with before.
Can you describe that in a little more detail?
It's like, I think as humans, we're so in our heads, right? Our heads are kind of our operating system and they just, especially these days, are just on overdrive. And because they're so loud and busy, right, we are emotions and our feelings, we don't pay much attention to, and there's not a lot of space to. But when we get quiet, that's when we can tune into those feelings. But for me, it had to be very conscious. Mm-hmm. It had to be a concerted effort to understand what I was feeling in any given moment. So one of the things that I like to do is I do a full body scan. So I sit, and I can do this at any point in the day, even if you're not seated. I close my eyes, I check in, and I just notice sensation in my body. I scan my body from head to toe. All right, where am I feeling sensation? Okay, my hips are heavy. My stomach is a little fluttery. My chest is like constricted, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And then the next piece, I'll pick like, you know, three things that are the most pronounced. And then I ask myself, what are the feelings behind the sensations? And just to name some core feelings. So what I notice in that is like, oh, I feel happy and I feel sad. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel angry and I feel like creative. I feel really alive. And then the next thing I ask myself is, what's the thought behind the feeling? Uh-huh. And that just gives me a little information about, first, what am I feeling to even recognize it and to check in on it. And then, what's behind that? Early on, when I couldn't really get in touch with my feelings, I would, and I read a book, I think it was Miguel Ruiz's Voice of Knowledge. And he said in the book, like, check in. Like, when you're with somebody, like, how do you feel? Is your stomach in knots with this person? Are your shoulders tight? You know, or do you feel like effervescent and loose and relaxed? And like, you don't actually even need to know or name that feeling or even the thought behind it. You just need to know that it exists. I talked about meditation and yoga. Yoga is such a great gateway to allowing yourself to connect with your body and feel sensation and let emotions and feelings arise. Sometimes it can be a little bit like, oh, what do I do with this? But those blockages, what yoga does on a cellular level is that we have all of these energy pathways, these nadis in our body. So acupuncture, that's what they're working on, the meridians in your body. And so the spine is the shishumna, the like central axis. And then off of that is thousands and thousands of little rivers of energy or nadis that flow through our body. And when we're feeling blockage, physical blockage, emotional blockage, it manifests physically in our bodies. And when we do yoga, what we're doing is we're clearing out those energy lines so that we can feel more effervescent, have more energy, more vitality, and then also really move those feelings through us, like I talked about before.
Yeah. All right. Why don't we move to question 7? Do you own your shit or does your shit own you?
Do I own my shit or does my shit own me?
Yeah.
I'd like to think I own my shit. And I think that goes back to just this radical accountability, which was really just a way of getting out of being a victim and feeling like a victim was just, you know, seeing that no matter what, I'm always a part of something that is happening or anything that's happening in the moment. And what is my piece in it? And if I can look at that, then I would say I'm owning my own shit. If I'm not, then my shit's owning me.
Yeah. And how do you then know? I mean, the trick is like, because it seems to me one of the problems with coming to terms with your own shit is if you acknowledge it, that means you kind of have to do something about it. Whereas if you pretend it's not there.
But I'm all about doing something about it.
Well, that comes through. It seems like that's a
And trying to, you know, change it.
So but then the question is, how do you, but I think it's, that's the problem of the unconscious, because even if we are consciously deliberately like, okay, this is going to be a major part of my life is being forthright, aware, conscientious, there's still an unconscious mind. It's like, no, we're going to keep all of this stuff in the back.
So, you know, I sit here all almighty, like, oh yeah, I own my shit. But yeah, there's a part of us that's running the show that we don't have a handle on for sure. And we have our old patterns, you know, that we're trying to shift and change. So I would say, again, like I'm a work in progress. I try to own my shit. But the truth is there's plenty that takes a hold of me and stuff that I do that I'm unconscious about.
You've been teaching yoga for a long time. And in a lot of ways, yoga is about owning your shit. And it's a place where you can come to recognize and see it. And so I'm curious the advice that you give your students in those, let's think of yoga as the modality of doing this.
Well, the beauty of yoga is that it works on its own. So I don't need to tell anyone to like open their eyes and wake up and look at themselves. Yoga, the system of yoga works on its, you know, on itself. So like you had talked about coming to my class and I don't say a lot, you know, about kind of Eastern philosophy approaches because I do believe that the technology, the system works on its own. And by people just showing up, they're eventually going to.
But you know, one thing I really like about your class is that you start with an intention and then you give a little reading and then you let the yoga sort of, you sort of drop the little droplet in the pool and then the yoga's happening and the droplet's diffusing through as the yoga practice. And a lot of times when I'm in your class and I'm doing that, and something you've said at the beginning is kind of bouncing around and registering as I'm doing this. And
yeah, I mean, I think it's really the breath work. I really talk a lot about the breath work in yoga.
Can we talk about that some more? Cause you know, we hear a lot about breath work and there are various breath practitioners that are out there. What have you learned about breath work? Tell me a little bit more insight.
Yeah, I mean, I think breath work, for me, I think it's the most transformative modality in a way, more so maybe the same as yoga, but maybe, well, maybe I shouldn't equate it and say more so than meditation. But for me, it feels really vital. It's what actually, so pranayama is a Sanskrit term for it. And prana is our own life force or energy within us. Mm-hmm. And when we do different breathing techniques, ujjayi breathing included, so you're doing that in yoga. And that's why yoga feels so different than most other forms of physical exercise, you are increasing your energy flow. And so those blockages in your body, those are all opening up. So all those nadis and rivers are flowing. And so you have this sense of aliveness, vitality when you do the breath work. As well, it can be very grounding and calming for the nervous system. So for a lot of people, and for most of us in this day, we're living in kind of a fight or flight mode, our nervous system, sympathetic nervous system, where we're in this heightened state all the time. Something happens at work, you know, and your boss yells at you, you leave the situation and most times we haven't really come down from it unless you've moved those emotions through you by walking, yoga, meditation, going, you know, et cetera, being creative, movement, and the breath work. When certain types of breath work, we are down regulating our nervous system. Mm-hmm. And so for a lot of people, that's really hard. For people that have anxiety, depression, it's vital. And for those people with depression, sometimes the thoughts in the head are so dark that sitting in silent meditation does not work for them.
Yeah.
Breath work works beautifully because you actually are concentrating and having to concentrate on something.
Uh-huh.
And when you're concentrating on your breath work, you're out of your head, or I shouldn't say you're out of your head. You're never out of your head, but your head and your thoughts quiet down. And on a cellular level, on a nervous system level, you're going from flight or fight to feed and breathe. You know, rest and breed.
Like, I like feed and breed.
Feed and breed. But it's true though. That's like, can you eat when you're in like flight or fight mode?
Yeah,
like,
right.
No, your adrenals are kicked up. We're like, you know, looking for the tiger that's coming after us.
Yeah.
So as a teacher, I feel like the breath work does almost as much, if not more, for a lot of people than meditation.
Let's move to question 8, which is, how do you find love?
You don't find love. Love is all around you and within you. So for me, it's really just being open to it,
mm-hmm.
to giving it and receiving it. But it's omnipresent. Mm-hmm. It's always there.
So love is one of those ideas like spirituality. It's oftentimes very hard for people to know what it is exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit of how you know love?
I think of love as like the essence of the universe. I feel like we're all just made up of love. There's two states of being, love and fear. Mm-hmm. And you're either in fear or you're in love.
Mm-hmm.
It's one or the other. So pick.
Yeah.
Well, A or B.
Yeah. But I mean, here's the challenge. Sometimes we're in a fear state. And we don't want to be in a fear state.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of course we want to be bathed in love, but it's either not available to us or we're afraid and the fear is blocking out the love or precluding the love experience. What's your wisdom around that?
I think when love is withheld, if we have an experience of it being taken from us or withheld, the practices that I go to are practicing forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
I think forgiveness is a real profound way to access love with another person that isn't willing to give it or receive it, to engage with it.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about that? Like, so how do we do that? How do we know if we're really forgiving someone versus just kind of mouthing the words? Does that question make sense?
Totally. Because for a long time, I worked for so long to forgive my parents for whatever they did. And I was like, oh, did I get it? Is it now? Is this it? It's kind of like falling in love,
mm-hmm.
you know, when it's like unconditional and so beautiful. And until you experience that, you're like, is this love? Is this love? You know, it's like the book, is this my mother?
Yeah.
and we have to try it on and like, oh, and you don't really know until you experience maybe a different kind of love. So eventually with my parents, I was like, am I forgiving them? Am I forgiving them? And then one day I woke up and I was like, I've completely forgiven them. Like there's no charge. There's no emotion or feeling or fear or anger or blockages around this person. And I think you can work on it and try to do it. So for me, it would be a metta meditation is a loving forgiveness meditation. I write out my own forgiveness, like prayers, and then I repeat them. I visualize, I close my eyes and I visualize that person in, you know, in front of me. And one meditation that I do is like giving that person, like they have a bag and they're holding a bag and I just give them everything back that they like did to me or all their baggage, all the shit that I don't like about this person. And they put it in a bag and I stuff it in the bag. And then I see them holding the bag and I imagine them as a small child. Mm-hmm. And it's like, at our essence, this child was innocent, was full of love, and whatever happened to them in their lives brought them to this place, to the state that is out of a love state. And I can just access that like compassion for that person, that they're just another human being yearning for love and acceptance. And maybe they didn't get it somewhere in their life. And it's perspective.
Yeah.
You know, and I teach that a lot with my students, you know, of like, instead of saying, I have to go to the store, I get to go to the store. I get to go and buy food for my family. Yeah. I get to cook for my children, you know. So
I'm not having to forage this.
Yeah. And it's just how quickly, and it, you know, again, I hate to say the word gratitude because it's become so, you know, gratuitous, but it really is. It can shift your mindset and your overall well-being, your emotional well-being on a dime.
Yeah.
It's like the quickest like hack that you can find.
So question 9 is, where are you going from here?
I don't know.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that. I was like, oh, this is going to be a great question because you're just like here.
I don't know. I'm going to go with the flow. Yeah. Just, you know.
Yeah.
How do you, on the one hand, say, okay, I'm in the moment. I'm going to be fully here, present. That's my commitment. It's to be real, to be open, to be kind of as fully engaged with where I'm at right now as I can. But I've also got to figure out what I'm doing next week.
Yeah.
And, you know, or next month. And, you know, and how do you, how do you negotiate that?
I'm glad you asked that question because I think it's, I sound like, oh, I'm just blowing in the wind. You have this like hippy dippy.
Amy.
And I'm not that. I actually am a very intentional person, you know, and very interested in writing my own story and knowing that life is fleeting. And how do I want to spend these like, you know, precious days in this life, knowing at any moment it could be done. So I do think a lot about, and there's a lot of intentionality around my goals and my life. I visualize how I want my life to look like and how I want it to unfold. And I do a lot of practices around that. So Shakti Gawan was kind of the first, I will say, person to kind of talk about these like affirmations and visualizations and manifestations. Her book is called Creative Visualization. Mm-hmm. And it just required really thinking about all the different compartments of your life, facets of your life, and how do you want them to look like? How do you want them? And for me, it's like how it looks like and really how it feels. Like I'm very much a feeling-based person. Mm-hmm. And I would, and I still do, I write out words. I'll write whole paragraphs about how I feel in my life right now or in one aspect of my life, what it looks like. I'll draw pictures. I'll cut out pictures. And then part of my practice is every morning looking at those pages. And even the times when I don't do in the pages because it ebbs and flows, I'm thinking about it. I'm pretty intentional about that.
How do you know when you're getting too caught up in what the future may hold? Mm-hmm. And do you have anything that happens for you where you're like, oh,
I'm off track. I'm not in the moment anymore. I've been thinking about what's going to happen next week and planning this out. And then boom, I'm lost in it. And I've been lost in it for a set period. I guess it goes to a moment of like conscious recorrection or recorrection of consciousness.
Uh-huh.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, it's like I visualize and I put intention and I put energy and purpose into certain things, but when it doesn't maybe work out the way I wrote and visualized, I'm able to just see that like, oh, there's a correction there and go with that. You know, it's very much like one door closes, another door opens. When a door closes, I don't keep beating on the door. I don't keep knocking on the door. It's like, oh, I'm actually being carried in this other way. And not that I'm just being carried away. I'm thinking about it.
Yeah.
But I'm also allowing myself to shift and pivot when necessary, when things maybe aren't the way that I visualize them. But I have to say, for the most part, when I get really clear and intentional, those things happen.
Yeah.
It's pretty like, if you keep a journal like this, I look back and stuff that I'm like, all right, I'm going to put it down, but there's no way that I'd ever be able to achieve this. I'm like, oh, there it is.
You know, I think it's hard for us as Americans. We don't realize how much productivity pressure we live under. I mean, I carry this around like, if I didn't do something meaningful and productive today, this is a bad day. And like, you know, there's this real pressure to like feel like every moment has to be optimized in some way. And then, of course, then we spend hours on the phone, social media, and trying to distract ourselves then, you know, or self-medicating in whatever, you know, way we want to. But then when we're not doing that, then there's like, and I think it's distinctive to our culture more than others, or at least it's very strong in our culture. And I try to keep that in mind sometimes too.
Yeah, I feel that way. And I'm definitely a worker bee. And that's been part of my practice. One of the things I think about, I think it's a Thich Nhat Hanh book. It's instead of trying to be extraordinary, try to be ordinary.
Yeah.
And I think about that because I think from a young age, I felt like I had to kind of go out and prove myself and accomplish a lot of things and change the world and all that. And that idea of just like, can you be with the ordinary, and that and the ordinary is actually this extraordinary, you know, and that kind of gets back to my like being alive and awake and present to actually take in the extraordinary aspect of life.
Yeah. The greatness of small things.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for sharing all of this and sharing your great wisdom.
Oh, thanks, Eric. It was a pleasure to be here.
Yeah.
Great. And talk with you.
If you feel like you're getting a lot out of our show, there's another University of Chicago Podcast Network show you should check out. It's called Entitled. Human rights matter, but conversations about rights can be polarizing, confusing, and frustrating. On Entitled, lawyers Claudia Flores and Tom Ginsburg have traveled the world getting into the weeds of global human rights debates. They use that expertise to explore the stories and thorny questions around why rights matter, and what's the matter with rights? Subscribe to Entitled, part of the award-winning University of Chicago Podcast Network.